Y'all better put him in the Heisman.
Got that wood right here, baby.
This is the Bud Light Morning Rush Podcast, brought to you by Bud Light Lemon Tea, a unique twist on America's favorite light lager.
They're going to run and get that boot.
The Arkansas Razorbacks have completed the dream season.
A baseball team that's on the way back, a College World Series title. Stadium.
I almost got fired because I went Willie the Boss after I had a little too much sauce.
This is the Bud Light Morning Rush Podcast.
I know yesterday, of course, we'll get into all the things that were said, but Greg Sankey gets in front of everybody, mentions all the things that we thought he would mention, and for the most part, I was pretty pleased with some of the things that he said and some of the proposed changes that they're trying to at least adhere to and trying to work on and trying to develop.
I thought, really, he hit on all the points we thought he would. And he added one I didn't think was coming. That was the mental health aspect that they're trying to deal with their student athletes. I thought his address, which is really the state of the union of the league, was very comprehensive. There was a lot more time spent on officiating than I expected. Plenty of conversation early in his address about sports wagering and really the need for a national standard, if you will, the league and the presidents and the chancellors urging the NCAA to try to get some kind of legislation going where the and it seemed like the concern was really with the in-game betting.
Yeah.
And you say, well, what does that mean? Well, that, you know, there's going to be wagering out there that is this field goal going to be good or no good? You can bet on your phone instantly about this next play that's coming up. And the concern is not so much that you're wagering on that, but what's that do to the mental health of the student athlete? That kind of pressure's on that kick. I never even considered that fact. But one of the things that he really tried to tie those two issues together, John.
Yeah, and that was what was crazy about it, is that when sports wagering was brought up, I thought that he'd mentioned about this kind of the political answer of saying, you know, we're going to look into it. Obviously, this is the way that the sports side of things are going in this country, and da 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 da. But yeah, when he brought up the mental health issues and how they really have to focus in on that, you know, it really started kicking into me thinking about just in the college football games that I've watched and seeing how some of the players have, of course, the constant pressure on them game in and game out to perform. And also, you know, even people like the kickers, you know, who if they miss a kick or if they have a pressure kick on them, what's
or
the
pass,
aftermath?
Right. It's going to be on a variety of different stuff, perhaps.
Yeah, exactly. And so for them to really focus in on that and make sure that that is on the forefront of their minds and really their main focus on if this decides to develop and get into the same place, then that's when I'm going to start saying, okay, well, maybe, just maybe, it's going to end up being a positive thing, but also benefiting and making sure that the student athlete is taken care of. Because I know that that's always what they're going to say. They got to take care of the student athletes first. Student athletes first. And I agree with them that they need to take care of the student athletes. But to handle it that way and to really have that perception on it and look at it from that angle, I think was really impressive by Greg Sankey and the SEC. And if they decide to move forward with it, I think that a lot of people should have some confidence in, you know what, yeah, it's going to be a lot about sports wagering and not the end game, not the prop betting, but sports wagering a lot. But if that does happen, they're going to make sure that everyone else is taken care of on their side too.
Yeah, and so that will be a conversation that continues, because we know if they're counting on legislation, particularly from politicians in Washington, D.C., that's not happening anytime soon. And I think as this gets more widespread, as far as when I mean this being sports wagering becomes more widespread across our country and particularly across the college football landscape in the South, this will probably grow some legs and they'll get something handled there. Were you surprised he spent so much time kind of pulling the curtain back and really trying to explain what they're doing and how much they're investing on officiating right now, particularly football officiating?
I wasn't. I was kind of expecting there to be some comments made about it, but to see the amount of work and focus that they're putting into it, especially in the upcoming seasons, and because there's not some sort of policy that he could go up and say, hey, we're doing this, and this is going to fix all the issues we're having. I mean, that's just impossible. But the fact that he came out and said, you know what, we obviously understand that officiating is always going to be a hot button issue. We understand it with the day of social media. You have people always up in arms about that. You have the, he even mentioned specifically broadcasters when they have their expert officials there in the booth where he said sometimes they're right, sometimes they're wrong in their opinions. He was basically saying we need to stop having all of these opinions and all of these people coming at it from different angles and causing all of this chaos and making it much worse than what it needs to be. So we're going to open up the communication. We're going to have a social media account designated for officiating in the SEC. We're going to have a lot more communication and a better working relationship with the coaches and with the officials. We're going to try to make it all work and make it all easier for everybody to not only make the right calls, but also make sure that we're communicating those calls and being completely transparent. And I know, Tommy, you as an official, you're always about wanting to get the call right. And I feel like the amount of attention that was paid to it by Greg Sankey yesterday was really important, showing that, you know what, they understand it's really important to get it right. So we're going to do whatever we can to get it right and make it as easy as possible for everybody to make it right.
And that's the ultimate goal. Let's just get the play right. Let's just get the call right and not spend too much time doing it, but let's spend the appropriate amount of time to get the play right, because there's just too much at stake in these games. We've seen a coach here that another win here, a win there, and Brett Bielema may still be your head coach. He's really was that close with a couple of wins in some big spots, and a call here and a call there might make the difference. That's what's at stake. Not just coaches' careers, but hundreds of people that go along with that over calls. I mean, so these are important. But I think people have the idea that, again, officials don't care, there's no accountability, on, and they have a misperception, or they're wrong about what they think about goes on behind the scenes. And then, as you mentioned, I don't know what just happened. Computer decided to do its own thing. So it's back to what I was saying. Then people assume just because a referee, or pardon me, an announcer on ESPN or somewhere else says something about a play or a rule that it's right and the commissioner's accurate there. They need to get the broadcasters and the analysts and the officiating analysts and everybody kind of on the same page with communication, and that way they can decide, you know, that way they can get the information to the public. I can tell you there's been a lot of times I've listened to color analysts on TV broadcast make mention of a rule or make mention of a way a play was officiated, and they've been dead wrong about it. But the general public assumes because the person behind the mic said it that it's 100% accurate. That's not always the case.
Yeah, and I think that that's what's important, too, is that, you know, if someone who's not all in educated and knowledgeable in the what's the right call, what's the wrong call, or anything like that, a lot of cases, and I'm sure you know this better than anybody, Tommy, a lot of cases, common fans will just look to whoever is having the most outrageous opinion about it, been saying this cannot stand. How in the world is he officiating this bad? And sometimes it's cases of people who have a strong platform, some people on social media who have thousands and thousands of followers. And so a lot of people will start to believe, oh,
like
okay,
James Carville.
Like James Carville coming out and coming out and being very critical. So they get on that side. It's just almost like this mob mentality that keeps building up, even though the rule could be completely true and completely right in the call, but they don't care because it's like, well, James Carville. James Carville said it wasn't, and he's got all these followers, and he's the guy that knows, he's in the know, so it must be right. So I feel like that's another thing they're trying to eliminate, is just the armchair referees that feel like they know things, and then in reality, they don't. So trying to make that a little easier on the officials and on the communication process as well.
I think it's very good how they're going to have more open communication. And really, I think Greg Sankey's just tired of every damn Saturday his Twitter mentions get filled up with hatred and people just coming at him. Hey, got you a new place to go over here and let everybody know about it on a Saturday in October or September or whenever about what's going on. I think this isn't just for football. Now, we're obviously focused on football at SEC football media days, but this will be something I think we're going to see in basketball.
Yep.
In baseball, it probably won't be as big a thing because there's not quite the fan pressure most of the year, but there's certainly people that care about it. I think we're going to see this in football and basketball. This same Twitter account be very active for fans to get information, to point their anger for lots of things. And I really think at the end of the day, and listening to him talk yesterday and then listening to him on the SEC Now set with Dari and Gene Chizik and Jordan Rogers, this was the desire of the coaches in the league and the officials. And I can promise you when everybody puts their swords down and the heat of the battle is over on a Saturday afternoon, those two groups want to work together and have a better working relationship. It just gets hard to communicate properly and to communicate the way you'd love to about decisions made in the game when the heat of the battle's going on. And yeah. The best times to do that is in a non-combative, non-competitive situation. I think they've spent some time doing that. He referenced later in the day about brought all the basketball officials in with the coaches down to Destin, and it was a great working situation for them to have to have conversation about it. I think they'll continue to work on that in all their sports where officials and coaches can have a better working relationship, and that'll hopefully filter over into the games itself.
I also think it's really funny, too, when he mentioned that. He's like, yeah, some of you media members, we've invited you to be a referee during those spring games to kind of get an idea. And he mentioned that some of the reactions he got from media members, like, man, this is really hard to do. And it's like, that's why we're letting you know, is because when you call out these officials or when you're going on social media and saying how horrible these calls are, he's like, here you are putting in the position. So you got to make the calls, and it's not as easy as it looks.
Everybody thinks it's an easy thing to do. And you know, I don't work anywhere near that level, not even close to it. But I can assure you, it is a very difficult, high-pressure job that tens of hours a week go into working that four-hour game.
Yeah. I mean,
people don't understand the preparation. For every hour they're working the game, there's about four more hours that went into preparing for that game.
You're listening to the Bud Light Morning Rush Podcast, brought to you by Bud Light Lemon Tea, a unique twist on America's favorite light lager.
Now he does a tightrope act. Boy, Houdini's in the house. We're number three, and nobody's home to watch that house. Touchdown, Hogs! Holy Hog!
Logan Booker, the host of the morning show on 960 The Ref in Georgia, covering the Bulldogs. And I guess we have a lot of similarities because you're a Georgia grad, right?
Exactly.
So you kind of grew up a Bulldog fan, right?
Yeah, I grew up, and I consider myself a failed beat writer. You know, they try to make you put, like, unbiasedness, and you don't show your fandom. You find yourself in radio, it's a whole lot more fun. So.
Oh, yeah.
But glad to be back. It's good to be in Hoover, and glad to see you again. So welcome back.
Yeah, no, it's great to be back. And I know that at least coming from, I don't know if it's the same way from Arkansas fans, but I'm sure from the Georgia fan perspective, there's a lot of excitement, of course, going into this football season. So just kind of give us an overall feel of the fans and where they're at and excitement that they have and their feeling on Kirby Smart. Just what's the current status of the Georgia fan base right now?
Kirby Smart is still in a very much honeymoon period. He is the king of the state of Georgia right now, if you would. He can do no wrong in the eyes of the fan base. And a lot of folks outside would say, well, why is that? I mean, he failed against Alabama twice. He had him beat, then he couldn't beat him in the last minute. But I think what Kirby Smart is doing with the Georgia program is building a program that I think a lot of people believe will sustain for a while. And a lot of folks will point back and say, well, what did Mark Richt do? I mean, like, he was recruiting great at the same time. But I can say hands down that Georgia has never recruited at this level before. And to put the product on the field, we've got instances in, like, garbage time cupcake games where there's five stars all over the field in the fourth quarter up 60 points because that's just the depth chart right now. And it's just a really exciting time. I think a lot of people feel like Georgia's right there on the brink, about to do some great things. And we've tasted that, like, almost the pinnacle of college football, that god-awful second and 26 that people are still losing sleep over. I think a lot of people still look at the Georgia program as, like, this is a team that is only going to get better. Kirby Smart really has the support of the administration, the support of the school, a lot of things that wasn't really happening under the previous regime, that it feels like Georgia's Athletic Association is now all in, where there's been a lot of handcuffs in years past. But it's an exciting time right now, and I think Georgia fans, you know, despite the frustrations of the last couple of years, they're certainly as optimistic as I've ever seen them, and looking forward to this fall.
Well, let me ask you this, because when Kirby Smart was hired, I will admit I was skeptical, because I'm like, man, Georgia's a big-time program, yeah, hiring a coach who's never been a head coach before. And I always liked Mark Richt. I felt like Georgia should have been better, and I feel, right, like probably Georgia fans felt that same way. So, first off, why didn't it work with Mark Richt? What was the difference there, and why has Kirby Smart been able to capture that to where not only is Georgia doing really well and piggybacking off what Mark Richt was able to accomplish, but also they're competing for national championships, yeah, just within a few years?
I don't know if it didn't work under Mark Richt. It was a 15-year tenure where Georgia was a better program than when it was before Mark Richt arrived. I think over a 15-year span, though, you hit a certain point where if it's not going to happen now, or if it hasn't happened now, will it ever happen? And I think a lot of fans, you know, it's like any sport, it's not unique to Georgia, but you go a certain amount of time, you start getting antsy, you want the change. You want to think, hey, what is the other team on the other side of the fence? In this case, Alabama's the prime example. What are they doing to put themselves on a certain level? And hey, that assistant coach over there, that defensive coordinator that's recruiting lights out and winning championships, that's our guy. He went to the University of Georgia. He was a big-time player back in the 90s and a very beloved member of the Bulldogs, and it kind of slowly started coming out that he was interested in head coaching jobs. And all of a sudden, I think the domino effect that may have led to the hiring of Kirby Smart was when Steve Spurrier retired at South Carolina. Mm-hmm. A lot of chatter came up that, hey, South Carolina is very interested in Kirby Smart. And it was at the awkward time where Georgia was sort of having to make a decision. Are we going to keep Richt, or are we going to go somewhere else? And I think that was sort of one of the catalysts to say, we got to go get our guy now. Mark Richt, thanks for your time. You know, we appreciate everything, and we're going to go in a different direction. But now that Kirby's here, he just brings with him a different a philosophy of sorts. And I don't want to make this sound like I'm throwing shade at Mark Richt at all, because I know the guy, met the guy many times, loved the guy to death. But I think at the end of his tenure, he was very much a leader of a youth group, if you would. Not so much a football coach like he was the beginning of his career.
Right.
And I think that, I'm not saying he lost interest, but there was a lot of things that just wasn't happening, where when Kirby came in, it was football, 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 and we're going to recruit, you know, feverishly, and we're going to make this into a diehard football team again. And it's just the level he's been recruiting at has been, again, lights out, and he's been able to show that on the field, and it's been fun to watch so far. So I think it's a very optimistic time right now.
Speaking with Logan Booker, host of the morning show on 960 The Ref here in Georgia, talking about the Georgia Bulldogs. Logan, looking at just the SEC in general, yeah, obviously, we were talking in a previous segment about how Alabama Clemson seems to just be the national championship, mm-hmm, pick, and we're probably going to get it. It seems like year in and year out. I'm sure Georgia fans hope that's not the case, but in the SEC championship, it's kind of been that same way, where it's Alabama and Georgia. Mm. It's almost like butting into a fun rivalry, if you will. Do you see that being the same case this year, and maybe for years to come, as long as Nick Saban's at Alabama and Kirby Smart's at Georgia?
I think this year specifically, it would be a major disappointment if Georgia's not representing the East in Atlanta come December. I think that Georgia, the talent gap is just wide right now. You can make the argument, sure, Florida's gaining ground, if you want to say that, with they're getting better, but Georgia's also getting better. That's one thing that a lot of SEC East teams kind of fail to acknowledge, is that Georgia is putting together a number one recruiting class, followed by a number two recruiting class, currently like a number, I think, three or four recruiting class as we speak, expected to grow. Whereas Florida, use them as an example, they've averaged number 12 the last couple of years. They've lost guys to the NFL last year. So in their minds, they say, hey, you know, we had a good recruiting class, we must be gaining ground. Well, Georgia also has put together one of the more ridiculously historic recruiting classes they've put the last in their program, their history. But so I think the gap is very wide. I think Florida is very optimistic. I think Florida is a good enough program to beat anybody any given day, but it would take a lot to go wrong in Jacksonville for Florida to win that game. As far as the West goes, I'm pretty high on LSU right now. I think they've got a program that's going to be very, very good. Now, I'm going to eat crow, because this time last year, I did not think Ed Orgeron would be here at SEC Media Days. Lo and behold, he put a whooping on Georgia in Baton Rouge midseason and went on to, you know, finish fairly strong, and they've been recruiting lights out as well. That John Emery kid that Georgia had committed, the running back that's now going to be over there, I expect him to be one of those day one freshman impact running backs that LSU is going to be a force to be reckoned with. And Alabama's Alabama, and Alabama's great. Okay, we all know that. That's not no secret around here. But if there was ever a time that I think teams could step up and maybe nip Alabama in that bud, I think this might be one of those years to do so. And I think LSU might be one of those teams.
I'm always fascinated to get people's perspective, especially some people who are outside the state of Arkansas. Obviously, Georgia and Arkansas don't play each other this year, so it's not really on the radar. But just from your perspective, from an outsider looking in, what do you make of Chad Morris? What do you make of Arkansas? Because going 2-10 last year, it's not really inspiring hope in the Razorback faithful, and they're not really high on the program or Chad Morris right now. But just from your perspective, what do you make of that situation?
My question for you would be, what do you guys expect every year for Arkansas? I mean, like, when you go into a season, Chad Morris or no Chad Morris, I understand the daunting reality that you are in a division with Alabama, with Auburn, with Texas A&M, and LSU. That you lose sleep over that kind of stuff, okay? There's no doubt about that. But Arkansas, in years past, they've had up and down program. When you have a first-year coach like Chad Morris, I don't think there's any expectations at all. In fact, 2-10, it stings. But at the same time, like, you knew what you're getting into when you go through a coaching change, when you start making those progressions. I would give him a couple years before I really hit any kind of panic button at all. And great facilities being built in Arkansas. I mean, it's a program I think there is a little bit of buzz around. I mean, I'm a big recruit, Nick, like a lot of folks in Georgia seem to be, but you guys are recruiting better right now. The question is how does it match up against other teams in the division? How are they recruiting? And are we having to kind of wait on this cyclical sport that we love of college football for things to cycle where Alabama may fall from grace one day? LSU may fall from grace one day, but I don't know. It's one of those things that, and if you want my honest perspective from the East, it's we don't think much about Arkansas because they're just so buried in the SEC West depth chart, if you want to call it that.
Yeah, because the Razorback fan base, and a lot, because I've been asked, what is that expectation? What do they want? What is the thing that they feel like they should be? And it's not really necessarily a win total per year. It's more like Arkansas fans, by and large, feel like they should be better than the Mississippi schools year in and year out.
That's fair.
They feel like that they should be able to be better than Missouri, who they play every single year. They feel like there should be a better program. And then after that, it's kind of like just taking a couple wins here and there, maybe finding a way to beat an Auburn or beat an A&M or beat whoever. And that's what's just been the struggle, is that over the you went from Bobby Petrino when he was there, 21-5 in 2 years, to Brett Bielema, where there was some excitement because he was a big name, but obviously just did not work out. And the disaster that is right now is a lot attributed to him. And that's not to say Chad Morris is completely free of any sort of blame. But Razorback fans are just, they're very prideful. They love their program, but they also understand the things you said in the West and just how they get buried sometimes. Yeah. They feel like, how do we climb out of this freaking hole that we're in?
Well, Bobby Petrino is a great example. I almost forgot about him, honestly, that he did have that great few years at Arkansas where,
like, the only time they beat Georgia.
I know. But it does take a great coach. What am I saying? My verdict on Chad Morris is nowhere near ready to be read yet.
Yeah.
It's so new, and it's such a different realm of the SEC in a whole is what you're dealing with. Give it time is my only advice here. Just give it time. I would not hit any kind of panic button week one. Even, I mean, use Georgia as an example, lost to Alabama. A lot of people outside of the Georgia bubble are like, oh, well, how could you lose to Alabama? You guys should be embarrassed. That's Alabama. Okay,
yeah.
That's a team that a lot of people not named Clemson are having a lot of trouble trying to figure out right now. So give it time.
All right. Now, real quick, before we let you get out of here, though, I got to ask you about this. Florida, Georgia.
Oh, boy. No, wait. It's Georgia. Florida.
Sorry. Excuse me.
Please don't make that mistake on me. I'm
Georgia, Florida.
There you go.
Down there and Jacksonville. It seems like that game, it's always been part of it. I remember watching those games in the 90s and in the early 2000s and saying, man, this is an awesome thing. But it seems like now there's a lot of talk and controversy about not only the rival seems to be getting elevated a lot with Dan Mullen and Kirby Smart, but also the game being played there. What are your thoughts on the game still going there and being played?
I love it. As a University of Georgia alum, as someone that's made that migration many times with my fellow students, my family, my wife today, it's we go down to the islands of South Georgia, St. Simons, Amelia Island, Jekyll Island, and we make a week out of it. It's a lot of fun. It's tradition since 1933. The teams have played there except for 95 and 96 when they were renovating that thing. But it's just part of the culture of Georgia football. It's part of the culture of the SEC. A lot of folks call that a crown jewel. But now, back to the whole theme, I feel like we've been talking about the recruiting aspect of this sport. Kirby Smart eats, breathes, sleeps recruiting. When he looks at the biggest game, one of the biggest games on the schedule, as being taken off campus down to Jacksonville. What folks may not realize outside of the Georgia-Florida bubble is that you cannot host recruits at that game.
Yeah.
It's basically a weekend where you put recruiting aside and say, we'll get back to that when we get back in Athens in a couple weeks. That crawls all over Kirby's skin. He cannot stand that. So he's been sort of making a fuss about why are we doing this? And a lot of the, you know, numbers are coming in, like, why are we giving up a home game every 2 years to go to Jacksonville? But there is no right or wrong debate, other than I can tell you that Georgia fans are about split 50-50. It's a hot topic that we bring up on our show, unfortunately, too often, because it does generate a lot of conversation. But it's the contract is up in 2021. If I were a betting man, I think that will be the last year in Jacksonville. As much as it pains me, I hate to say it, but it's probably coming to a close.
Jeez, sounds like Arkansas playing in Little Rock at War Memorial Stadium, like the exact same argument. So we know where you're coming from. We know the frustrations that you have. Logan Booker, host of the morning show at 960 The Ref in George. Really appreciate you hopping
on
with us, man.
Thanks for coming.
Enjoy the rest of media days.
Absolutely.
And we'll be seeing you around, all right?
All right, John. Appreciate it, buddy.
All right.
You're listening to the Bud Light Morning Rush Podcast, brought to you by Bud Light Lemon Tea, a unique twist on America's favorite light lager.
Give is to Alex Collins straight up the middle, and Collins on the run. They won't catch him. Alex Collins is going to take it all the way to the house.
Richard Cross of Super Talk Mississippi. Richard, appreciate you joining us this morning. How you doing?
Yeah, good. You guys are ready to go. You got your energy drinks, you got your biscuits, and up and at them early this morning.
Yeah, that's right. Got the little NCAA football video game back here. I mean, yeah, we're all about it here, and that's what you got to do for media days, man. Stay energized for sure. But I want to talk to you about, obviously, with the Ole Miss Rebels. They're a fascinating team to me this year, obviously, because of not only the things that they have gone through over the past few years, but Matt Luke made some changes, had some Rodriguez to as the offensive coordinator role. Just what's the vibe and mood like right now for Ole Miss fans and going into the 2019 season?
Yeah, I think in a lot of ways for fans, it's tentative. Like, people want to be excited, but they know that this is kind of the next step in the process. Not to steal a Nick Saban line, different process I think we're talking about than what they've got going at Alabama. But, you know, when you look at the NCAA stuff, the probation, the scholarship restrictions, those are all now in the rearview mirror. But you've got to build your way back from a roster standpoint, from a confidence standpoint. And so that's what they're doing now. You know, the program never had the complete fall off the cliff, or at least that hasn't happened to this point. You know, you look at the last 3 years, Hugh Freeze's last year, they go 5-7. Matt Luke in the interim year, they go 6-6, and then they fall back to 5-7 a year ago. But this is the first year that they get back to a full 85 from a scholarship standpoint. I think they're excited about that, just to have some extra bodies. When they played Texas A&M in mid-November last year, it was with 67 scholarship players. I mean, that's less than what, you know, Division II or FCS schools are playing with from roster size or roster management standpoint. So I think that's part of it. And I know I heard you guys talking a second ago. The beginning of the season is so incredibly important. You know, if this team could get back to a bowl game this year, be the first bowl game since the end of the 2015 season when they played in the Sugar Bowl, that would really be a move in the right direction. And I think there are a lot of fans for lots of different reasons that are still in kind of wait-and-see mode and would like to jump back in, you know, feet first and be excited about it, but they just have kind of been snake bitten for the last couple of years, and so there's a little bit of a wait and see mode.
How do you feel like Matt Luke has handled the whole situation? Because I mean, it's tough on any coach to try to have to deal with the things that he had going against him, but how do you feel like he's handled it and where he's at?
I think he's done a really nice job, honestly. Again, I mentioned they've kind of avoided the nosedive sometimes you see, but that's not enough anymore. I mean, when you look at what coaches are being paid everywhere, you know, whether it's at Ole Miss or Arkansas or Alabama, you're not being paid to avoid a nosedive. You're being paid to win. Mm-hmm. I do think, and there's been an administrative change right now. Ross Bjork, who was the athletics director and hired Matt Luke and was very supportive of him, is now the AD at Texas A&M. So you're always a little curious when there's an administration change, although a new athletic director, a permanent one, has not been hired yet. Keith Carter's the interim athletics director for now, and there's a good relationship there. But I feel like in some ways there's some learning on the fly, learning on the job that goes along with it for Matt Luke. But he's been around a lot of good coaches, and he has shown a level of maturity that I think maybe surprised some with how he's gone about hiring coaches, I would say that that's what he has done better than anything else. And that's hire assistant coaches. And a couple of years in a row, he's had multiple spots on the staff. None evidenced more than this year when he hires Rich Rodriguez, who's a former coach of the year, and Mike McIntyre on the defensive side, who's also a former coach of the year.
Well, I wanted to ask you about Rich Rodriguez, because when that hire was made, it was pretty surprising to me, because I didn't know that would be a fit. But he's definitely a name, especially if you look back to his West Virginia days and how great those offenses were. What's kind of the expectation there for Rich Rodriguez and taking over with Matt Corral being in the quarterback there, at least presumably the quarterback? I mean, how is that going to work in the philosophy and in the strategy of how they're going to play in the SEC?
You know, really, we all should hate Rich Rodriguez, right? I mean, if we're being entirely honest, I mean, the course of the Southeastern Conference could be so drastically different if he would have just taken the Alabama job.
Signed on the dotted line.
It was so close to being done. I don't know what the fit's going to be like. Spent a very little bit of time around Rich Rodriguez. He's certainly a guy that's confident. He's seen a lot in college football. He's had a lot of success. I don't know if Matt Corral's Pat White. You know, he's a pretty good quarterback in Pat White out of Mobile when they really had things clicking offensively at West Virginia. Clearly, it didn't work at Michigan. There was some up and down at Arizona. I do think the structure that he will bring to the offense is going to be important. You know, if you look at what Ole Miss did for the last couple of years, they threw it a ton, and they threw it effectively, especially between the 20s. I mean, they were a fantastic 60-yard offense, you know, from 20-yard line, or I guess that's 80, a little early for math.
Yeah.
but between the 20s, I mean, it was up and down and – but there wasn't a lot of structure. Some of that was by design. I mean, some of that was what Phil Longo's offense was based on. There were options for wide receivers to try to find space. But when you talk about the athletic defenses that you have in the SEC, you got to commit to what you're doing. There's going to be more of an emphasis on running the football. A Rich Rodriguez offense is not exclusive to one thing or the other. I mean, you look at Khalil Tate, when he had a guy like that, they ran it. But there's also the ability to throw the ball, and Ole Miss still got some pretty good wide receivers.
Speaking with Richard Cross of Super Talk Mississippi right now on the Morning Rush Live from Media Days in Hoover, Alabama. I want to ask you about Week 2, because Razorback fans...
It's kind of a big deal.
Yes, it's a very big deal. In fact, Razorback fans, if they had to circle a game as far as the make or break for the season on the schedule this year, it's that second game of the season in Oxford.
Yeah.
Last year, they felt like they were in good position to win the game. They couldn't close out. They've had Ole Miss's number by and large for the past few years. So I'm curious. I know what the Razorback perspective is, because they know that that game's huge. What's Ole Miss perspective from that game as far as what it could mean for the season if they're able to get that victory?
It's absolutely the same thing. The thing for Ole Miss, though, is it's not just Arkansas in Week 2. It's the combination of Week 1 and Week 2. Ole Miss goes on the road to Memphis in Week 1. So that's, you know, that's a tricky, tough road game, because Memphis has been good. I got a quarterback coming back, you know, that put up some decent numbers in Brady White, but you know, that's one of those, you know, I don't know if Arkansas has a relatable opponent that's comparable to Memphis. Like, yeah, it's only an hour and a half away, and there are people that really like that rivalry and people that are like, just don't ever play them again. There's no reason at all to play that game. And I hate to be the guy that uses like, it's their Super Bowl cliche. But it's a really big deal for Memphis when you've got an SEC team an hour and 10 minutes down the road to, you know, pick up a win. On top of the fact that Memphis has been really good for the last few years. So there's no Portland State in Week 1 for Ole Miss to just kind of go out, get some reps, get your legs back, get, you know, feel good about yourself. So they got to go play in Week 1 on the road and then turn around and host Arkansas in Week 2. There is a roadmap and a pretty easy to read roadmap to 6 wins for Ole Miss, but that includes going 2-0 to start the year. You don't go 2-0. I mean, 1-1, maybe you can get to 6. You're 0-2, forget about it. I mean, it's got the makings of a 4-8 football team, and that would be really bad. I was just looking at the numbers a little while ago. So, what, Ole Miss snapped a 4-game losing streak to Arkansas last year?
Correct.
Rebels have lost 3 in a row in Oxford. at least one of those in about the most heartbreaking possible, you know, the most heartbreaking way possible with the
4th and 25.
That's one that won't die and cost Ole Miss a, you know, possible SEC championship. So I think it's always been a good series. And to me, the Ole Miss-Arkansas series is a fascinating one because you look at rivalries. That should be the biggest rivalry. Maybe not the biggest rivalry, but certainly a rivalry for these two teams because the history is there.
Yeah.
You know, whether it's in the 50s or 60s, and these are two teams that played each other a lot before Arkansas came into the SEC. Going back to the days when you had John Vaught on the sideline and Coach Broyles as well. So, to me, it's a fascinating game and a fascinating series. I feel like maybe Arkansas is a year away from where they want to be. Can you stack another recruiting class on top of the one that was coming in this year? I mean, it's hard to believe that they're not going to be better than they were a season ago. And Arkansas was good enough to beat Ole Miss last year.
Yeah.
So I hope it's not a pillow fight in week two. I hope it's fun. I mean, it's going to be a night game.
Yes.
And there should be a great crowd. My guess would be that Arkansas fans would travel well because it's so early and there's no disappointment that's built in. And it's an easy trip for a lot. So I think it's got the makings for a really good week two atmosphere and a fun football game. But no, to go to your original point, I think it's vitally important for both teams.
Well, I always like to get an outsider's perspective of kind of the Arkansas program and Chad Morris right now, because going 2-10 is hard to instill any sort of hope in a lot of fans. Yeah. I mean, I know that there was a time where Ole Miss kind of went through that same type of season, and I believe under Houston Nutt, they made a change. But you can't really do that in first year of Chad Morris. So
Houston Nutt, who's that?
Yeah, exactly. I've heard of him. He kind of has a relationship with Arkansas and Ole Miss. But what are your thoughts on Chad Morris and his job at Arkansas, or at least the job he's trying to do at Arkansas? What's your just overall feel for what he can do and maybe what he can accomplish at Arkansas?
You know, I can't help but think about Chad Morris when he was the hottest name in the country as an offensive coordinator. So when he was with Dabo and Clemson, his name was one that popped up. Oh, Chad Morris, next big thing. And it felt like there were maybe some opportunities for him to go to a bigger job initially. But when he went to SMU, it was almost like it was a little more off the radar. The thing to me that was impressive about what he did at SMU was his teams got better each year. You know, if you're looking at offensive production numbers, if you're looking at win totals, there was an increase there. I kind of feel like a year ago was year zero for Chad Morris, and I know that's hard for fans to swallow, to go, you know what, this year just doesn't matter. Because it's a year, and we're paying you $3.5 or $4 million, and you want us to buy tickets and suites and all those things. You can't just say it's year zero. Mm-hmm. But with the transition and with the roster flip that had to happen to make this new style work, I don't know that a whole lot more could be expected. I get it if a fan goes, look, you're in the SEC. There's no scenario where 2-10 is okay. I mean, even in a terrible year, you've got to be 3-9, 4-8, you know, right, whatever it is. Just going winless in the SEC is a hard pill to swallow. I completely get that. A little bit of a wait and see for me on Chad Morris.
Mm-hmm.
I want to see year two with whatever the quarterback situation. Who's it going to be?
It's probably going to be Ben Hicks to start. It might be Starkel once the season gets going, but yeah. I think it's going to be Hicks to start it.
So you think we'll see Ben Hicks in Oxford in week two?
Yes, I would say that that'd be the case.
And that makes sense. I mean, you're talking about the guy that's probably got the most familiarity with the offense and should be comfortable in it. So I think it's a little early to pass judgment one way or the other. I think I like where it's headed. Yeah, the recruiting thing is kind of interesting, though. People talk so much about that recruiting class a year ago. And it got off to a really fast start, which they needed to do.
Right.
But in the end, it turned out to be, what, 20, 21, 22, somewhere in there, which is right where Ole Miss and Mississippi State were. And that's great. I've always talked about this when we've talked about recruiting with Ole Miss. That's a top 25 class nationally. That's 11th in the SEC. Good luck with that. How are you going to make progress? So, you know, once you've got players in there that are top 25 type players, then to me that's when the coaching piece of it becomes a little more important.
Richard Cross of Super Talk Mississippi, we appreciate you hopping on with us. Obviously, I wanted to get a perspective of that week two matchup because I got to hear that it's just as important for Ole Miss as it is for Arkansas. Yeah. It's going to be a big one, though,
yeah,
no
it
doubt.
It really is. Look forward to seeing you there.
Hey, appreciate it, man, and just have fun. Rest of the media days.
Sounds good.
See
big
you
day today.
Yeah, big day today, no doubt about it.
You're listening to the Bud Light Morning Rush Podcast, brought to you by Bud Light Lemon Tea, a unique twist on America's favorite light lager.
We are joined by Billy Lucci, who's the executive editor and co-owner of TexAgs.com. Talk a little bit more about Texas A&M, who Jimbo Fisher and his players are going to go today. Really appreciate it, Billy. How you doing?
Oh, no problem. Doing well. Just like you said, yesterday, day one, felt like 4 days out here.
Yeah.
It's only
going
to get crazier today with four teams coming through. And busy these next couple days are going to be pretty insane for both of us.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. It's going to be a lot of fun, though, too. And I'm fascinated by Texas A&M because I feel like last year they really surprised me, at least, having the way that the season ended and winning nine games and looking as good as they did. And this next season, I was like, man, with the great recruiting that they've done, there could be even better. But then I see the schedule, and I'm like, they could end up being a better team, but may not have as good of a record when you're having to go to Clemson, you're having to go to Georgia, you're having to go to LSU, you still got Bama, you still got to go to Ole Miss. I mean, how do you balance that of the expectation of saying this team's going to be better, but also having that rough schedule?
It's funny. You could – I mean, you're playing both teams that played for the national title. You're playing both teams that played for the SEC title. You're playing preseason number 1, 2, and 3 and whatever LSU is going to end up, 7, 8, whatever that is. And not to mention, let's not talk about how tight their games were last year against Arkansas, final possession, against Ole Miss, trailing in the third quarter, pulled away late. They lost to Mississippi State. They lost to Auburn. Both those on the road, of course. You'll get them at home. And South Carolina was a tie game in the fourth quarter. So not even factoring in that, you look at those four games that kind of sit atop the whole thing, and it's wild to think A&M, in theory, could be, what, let's say the eighth best team in college football and go 8-4.
Yeah.
I mean, they wouldn't finish ranked eighth,
right.
But I mean, if you just had some metric and said this is the eighth best team taking the field this year, they might lose to number 7, number 3, number 2, number 1. So it is. It's tough to reconcile those two things. Plus, here's the other thing no one's going to probably talk about much today is Texas A&M is a they're not young, okay? I don't want to say young.
Right.
They got a lot of juniors. They're going to start one senior.
Oh, wow.
They're going to start one senior out of 22 this fall. I've been doing this 20 years. 21. This will be my 21st year. Never seen that. Never seen a team start one senior out of 22 on a football team. Not an A&M team anyway. So they're not young, but the next couple of years are what should be the real breakthroughs for Jimbo Fisher and this team. Those should be the breakthrough seasons. And you talk about that recruiting class, and the end of 2018 was really good. The 2019 was ranked third. So by 2020, those guys are going into their second year. Plus, you only lose you maybe a couple guys leave early. You lose two or three starters out of 22. And then after that, you're stacking recruiting classes. They'll probably be a top 10 haul this year. What if A&M does? The question I think everyone needs to ask is, what if they do get there a year early? What if they're noticeably better? What if one out of Clemson, Georgia, Alabama, LSU, probably not Clemson or Bama, but what if one of them take aren't nearly as good as they're thought to be?
Mm-hmm.
Instead of a top 5 team, what if they're a top 10 team and A&M wins a close game? So, you know, I think that's the fun part about this team, and I think they're probably one of the toughest to peg down this year because they do have a veteran quarterback. They do have a coach with a track record of developing quarterbacks and turning them into high-end pro prospects. And so what if your QB takes that jump? What if the second year in the system, those talented receivers play every week like they did against Clemson and against LSU. There's a lot of what-ifs for this team, and the biggest one is what if that schedule just ultimately wears them down and they're a, you know, 4- or 5-loss team, and like you said, maybe a little bit better than they were a season ago.
Well, and Jimbo Fisher, you brought him up as having the track record of success, obviously at Florida State. When they hired him, he's a rock star hire. It's hard to argue that you could have gotten a better hire if you're Texas A&M. But given all of these things going for him, I know the schedule's tough, but the recruiting classes, the support, the experience that they're having, I mean, there in Aggieland, is the expectation getting to the point to where, you know, they understand tough schedule, but here in the next 2-3 years, they expect to maybe win the West, play for a national championship? I mean, what are they expecting considering how great things are going right now?
I think they're expecting a championship, and I think you talk to the players, and that's the biggest thing I've noticed is those kids in the program believe they're coming to A&M to win a national title. They believe that while they're being recruited, they believe it when they get on campus, and it only gets stronger as they stay. And it's not really a cocky thing. It's just that's where Jimbo's taken us. I sense the veteran players, I only hear them talk good about the younger players, the freshmen coming in. There's no jealousy, I mean, because they believe like, well, these guys are coming in to help us win a championship. They're coming in, they're going to make us better. Oh, wow, that guy's really good. I'm not worried about him taking my job. I'm excited because we're getting better. Mm-hmm. And it's a completely different culture than I've been used to seeing with Sherman, where it was kind of like, they were just hoping to get there one day, but it wasn't. And in Sumlin, it was more about the sometimes you could see like a style over substance thing. And I haven't seen it like this. I haven't seen just that, hey, this is what we're going to do. We're going to win an SEC. We're going to build this into a top 10 program, and we're going to reach playoffs and win a national title. We know how hard that is.
Oh, yeah.
But you're not going to get there if that's not the culture inside your program, and you got a head coach that's done it, so it adds a lot of credence to it, not only for the players to believe, but he knows what it takes. You know, Jerry Schmidt, the strength and condition coach, knows what it takes. He's done it at OU, so mm-hmm. I think that's the biggest difference, and I really believe this. Will they win one under Jimbo Fisher? I don't know. I mean, that's so hard. You know, you look at Clemson. Who would have ever thought Clemson would win multiple titles under Dabo, and they've done it. You got a head, a national championship head coach. You're giving him kind of everything he wants, and you're plopping him right in the middle of the state of Texas as the only SEC school in that league. And we've seen the early returns, both on the field, like you talked about. Look, in 1 year they erased that A&M's fades in November. A&M is out conditioned. They can't win games in the second half. Those were gone in year one. Who's to say they won't take a huge leap in year two, or who's to say they don't survive it and then make that leap afterwards? But it's trending that way. Will they win one? Who knows? There's some really good teams that don't win them for long stretches of time, mm-hmm. but I think they've got everything in place to do it and kind of really threaten Alabama, say, from 2020,
right.
A little 5-year window there because of the way they're recruiting, and it kind of should start next season. The big question today, I think, should be, can it start now? Not can they win a national title or win the SEC, but can they go 9-3 and shake up the playoff race? Can they go 10-2 and completely screw up everything? Yeah. Who knows?
Yeah. Well, and it's fascinating because they're obviously on the right track, and time will tell. And, you know, you mentioned the game against Arkansas earlier. That one's a weird one that I can't figure out.
Nope.
Because A&M has beaten Arkansas every year since 2012.
All but one have been.
Yeah. I mean, Bobby Petrino and Tyler Wilson were on Arkansas staff and quarterback when the last time Arkansas beat A&M. But for whatever reason, even though A&M may be talent-wise far and away better than Arkansas, or even if Arkansas has had a huge lead late in the game, somehow, some way, it's always close, and A&M always ends up on top. Do you have any explanation for why this game always ends up being that way?
No, because if there was ever a year where I would have said A&M would... During the year, a lot of those close games, you go back and look, and Brett Bielema's teams played plenty of teams tough. Mm-hmm. They won games later in the year and where you go, okay, this is a lot better team than we thought they were earlier in the year. A&M's going to always get Arkansas's best shot because of where they're playing the game.
Yeah.
And it's neutral, and A&M's going to get their best shot. But I don't think the Aggies, at the end of the day, you look at it, they weren't really that much better than Arkansas in those years. They just were ranked really high at that time before the truth really came out.
Yeah.
And it's like every year Arkansas would kind of expose that, like, look, the gap between these two teams isn't very big. And that's why they're playing such close games. For whatever reason, A&M believed they would beat Arkansas, and Arkansas didn't believe. And you saw that as soon as push came to shove, the Hogs would blink. They didn't want to.
Right.
They fought like hell. They would blink. A&M wouldn't. They had that confidence. Last year was the one where I go, all right. Like, this is just how it's always going to be, because you look at how the season's ended, and A&M
yeah.
was way better. A&M, now A&M got to be a much better team later in the year.
Right.
But Arkansas was putrid early in the season when the Aggies played them. And they jumped out. Was it 17-0 or was it 17-7?
I think it was 17-7. I know they returned the opening kickoff for a touchdown.
It was at least 14-0.
Yeah.
And if there was ever a time where I was thinking A&M's going to run these guys out, their quarterback plays atrocious. It's
mm-hmm.
And they still couldn't do it. You know, they had chances there early in the second half. Kellen throws a pick, a couple missed field goals there. They still couldn't do it. So I don't know that that's ever going to happen. And I think this year, again, you want to talk about these tough games. Arkansas is going to be tough. And now, if I don't know, you guys know a lot more than me, if Nick Stark will end up winning that starting job, time will tell. I think he's got his work cut out because, you know, the other guy being in the system and having mm-hmm. the spring there. But you've got an A&M quarterback. You've got an A&M tailback in Rakeem Boyd. You've got John Chavis, who left, I think, extremely bitter about how things went down at A&M. And I don't understand why, because I think he did a pretty terrible job at A&M. You've got Ron Cooper, who coached at A&M.
Mm-hmm.
Arkansas hired one A&M recruiting director. He left to go back to A&M. They went off and hired a guy from ULL that had come up under Sumlin at A&M. And, oh, by the way, you've got Chad Morris, who's an Aggie coach. You've got your special teams coach, Traylor, who lobbied hard for the A&M job, not once but twice.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, these dudes want to beat the Aggies badly.
Yeah.
And there's not a game, and it'll be interesting. Chad Morris won't reference A&M this week, will he?
He never seems to.
Which only adds to it. You go, these dudes really want to end that streak. And I think if there's one game they'd want to win on the schedule, it's A&M, but none of them say it, but we all know it. So it's going to be the same deal.
Yeah.
And again, that's one where in the first six games or so, A&M plays Clemson, Alabama, Auburn. You can't lose to Arkansas.
Yeah.
So all the more reason it's going to be a close game, because the Aggies are going to be feeling a lot of pressure to go out there, and they have to win that game. Arkansas doesn't, but boy, do they want to.
Yeah. No, that's a great point about the connections there to Texas A&M, because, yeah, there's a lot of correlations and relationships there, and that's probably a big part to why they care so much about that game. Should be another great one this year.
Yeah.
Billy Lucci, executive editor and co-owner of TexAgs.com. Really appreciate you hopping on with me,
no
man.
Problem.
Try not
Thank
to work
you.
Too hard today, all right,
you
man?
You too, you too.
Your number one source of local news and information you need.
Like the Bud Light Morning Rush podcast? Check out the Halftime Pod at hitthatline.com.